An interview with Professor Howard Scarrow of the Department of Political Science, Tuesday, November 22nd, in my office.
All right.
Well, it's very chilly these days.
Kind of yak college, Hampton, Connecticut.
I'd forgotten all about him until I see his name there. My gosh, that is out of the blue.
A strange looking person.
Is he?
Big beard.
Yeah.
Anyway. Let's go through a few of these questions. Your name, department, rank, or position now?
Well, now, Howard Scarrow, Department of Political Science, and I'm a full professor.
Right. What year did you come to Stony Brook?
It was January 1963.
January?
Or February. It was mid-year.
Mid-year.
Right, and that's why this is my 25th year. I've just been notified. Also, another thing, Carl, you would very much remember. This very day, 25 years ago, you know where you were? I was attending an executive committee meeting of the faculty then, and I was faculty secretary or something. I remember you came in and said the president had been shot.
Is that right?
Yeah. Is that?
Must have been.
Am I right on that?
Yes, I think I was there.
I know that you're the one who relayed the message to me.
Yes.
But then the problem, I wasn't, I'm wondering, did I come, therefore, did I, must have come in January. Well, wait a minute. Yeah, that's right. Because you asked me when I came, that was January 63. Yes. He was shot in November 63.
Yes.
By which time, I had assumed the august position of secretary to the faculty, and
right.
That gave me entree, or that may be part of the executive committee.
Yeah.
And,
right.
Yeah. And I very much remember we were sitting in this library in its old, old configuration, and you had been called from the room, presumably, by a phone call, and you came and announced to those of us who were sitting there that the president had been shot. And I think we dismissed the meeting at that point. Yep.
I remember I wrote a little statement, and it was put on the bulletin boards.
Uh-huh.
And Dave Tilley told me subsequently that statement did more to make the students look differently at the administration, more favorably at
uh-huh.
the administration, than anything that had happened up to that point.
That's interesting. Yeah.
I remember the students wanted to plant a tree somewhere
uh-huh.
out in a one of the dormitory, I think it was G. Dorn, they wanted to plant a tree outside the cafeteria, I think. And I went out there and stood with them.
Incredible the impact that thing had on all of
them. It had a tremendous impact.
And I remember last night, as we were watching the program on Channel 13, I asked Rowena and also my son, who's home now, what if a president was shot today, whether it's Bush or Reagan or anybody, Carter, would there have been that impact? We'll never know until it happens again. But there was something about that period that was just incredible.
I think that Kennedy had gotten across to the American people a certain kind of idealism with respect to the country and what was expected of the citizenry. Primarily from his inaugural address. And we were all caught up in that euphoria isn't quite right, but caught up with
the spirit.
The spirit,
yeah,
yes.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, I don't think that in some ways Bush's has not gotten across yet. I think he may. Something depends on how he handles himself. Reagan, Reagan's being shot, and the way he took it came close to getting across to the country that here's a an individual who is courageous and humorous, doesn't take himself too seriously. But these things come out in ways and under circumstances you don't.
That's right.
You can't foresee.
Yeah.
So you came in January.
January 63. Yeah.
63.
Right.
How old were you at the time?
Well, let's see. If I've been here 25 years and I'm 60, I guess that made me.
45.
45. Well, no, 35. 35. Right. Yeah. 35. That shows how arithmetic is. 35. Wow. A youngster. And I came from Michigan State, and the reason I had started mid-year is that I had a Social Science Research Council fellowship to take me to Canada. I didn't want to give that up, so we had spent the fall semester doing research in Ottawa, and then we came down here. And so when I had visited in the spring of 62, I visited the campus at Oyster Bay. And so when I arrived, I came to the campus at Stony Brook.
Yes.
Now, Martin Travis had drove me out here in the spring, or had done, anyway, I had seen the bulldozers at work, so I wasn't totally.
Who was responsible primarily for your coming?
Well, it was Martin Travis. I was his graduate assistant at Duke University, and so, when I learned that he was chairman, actually, I had occasion to correspond with him when I thought he was still at Stanford, and the thing got forwarded to him, and he wrote me back, by the way, I'm here at Stony Brook, which, of course, I never heard of. Or actually, it was in Oyster Bay, but et cetera, et cetera. And he said, I'm chairman, and would you like a job? And, well, I thought about it, and I was, as I say, I was at Michigan State. There's several factors there I didn't particularly like, and also it wasn't 100% certain I was going to get tenure, so I had to sort of say, well, do I take a chance, or do I want to go or not? So I had to, well, why don't I look at it anyway? Frankly, I thought Long Island and Staten Island and Manhattan Island were more or less synonyms for a skyscraper country. And of course, I came out and saw Martin's beautiful home in Oyster Bay and saw that Long Island was indeed not the same as Staten Island or Manhattan Island. And so that sort of convinced me. Also, the weather was a beautiful day like today rather than the cloudy Midwest. So everything combined to make me think, my gosh, maybe I should do this. So I accepted the position with the caveat that I could continue my plans to go to Ottawa, which I was going to, you know, spend the fall semester there. So that's how it happened, a sort of providential series of accidents, really.
How did you know Martin?
Well, he was at Duke University when I was a PhD graduate student.
I see.
And I was assigned to him as his grader. I graded a couple papers for him. He didn't work me very hard, for which I was very grateful. So we met at Duke, and then he left Duke and went to Stanford, and then Stanford, he came here.
Was Waldo Beach at Duke?
Yes, he was. He was indeed. I remember the name. In the religion department.
He's just retired.
Oh, has he?
Yeah. I knew the family. I knew his older brother. And his younger brother. His middle brother. Number six. Number five. Anybody else interview you?
No. Well, I remember I had dinner with Harry Kalish when I came out. So the three of us had dinner. So Harry was one of the salespersons who tried to convince me what a great place this was. So that was a lot of fun. And
Ross?
Stan, I'm trying to think. I don't think, maybe I did meet Stan Ross, but he, of course, he was just a professor of history then. He didn't assume his administrative jobs until later. I probably did. My recollection of Stan is so strongly influenced by his subsequent activities that I sort of blurred out whether I met him at that one visit or not.
Let's see. You're talking about a visit in 62?
Yes, that would be the spring.
Oh, Stan.
Well, maybe he wasn't even here then.
He wasn't here then.
Yeah, because
he
did. All right. That's right. You're right. It was this tremendous turmoil with Lee, was that his name?
Yes, right.
In fact, I think that's more or less all Kalish and Martin talked about while I was sort of listening to the infighting or whatever you want to call it that was going on at that point. Yes, that's right. So it was just a transition period, very much so. And but
you came in the winter of 63.
Yes. So you must have come just in the fall.
I came in September.
September
62.
Of 62. Yeah. Right. So you had been here only 3 or 4 months by the time I arrived.
Okay. Have you explained that six to your...
Well, I think, why did I come? It was a combination of positive attraction here plus some negative factors at Michigan State, not the least of which was the lousy weather. As being a Michigander, I know exactly what Michigan winters are like, and so that was one factor. A lot of, then as I say, the uncertainty of whether I had tenure, I had to sort of take a chance on that. Conceivably I would have, conceivably I wouldn't have, but...
Did you come with tenure?
So I came, and that was one of the factors, that understandings, that I don't know if it was formally, but the understanding was that would be implicit, that I would get it ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
I remember discussing this with a colleague at Michigan State, whether I should come or not, and he said, and he's still there, Joe Schlesinger, he says, you know, tenure is a fiendish device invented by universities to keep people at the university, because he said the worst thing that can do to a person, but the best from the point of view of the university, is gives people tenure, because it immediately sets in inertia. Why do I want to leave? But as long as you don't have tenure, you're just uncertain enough that you're willing to take chances, to go places. And says it seems to me that, there's another thing, plus the fact that the salary was going to be considerably more. I think I was earning $4,500 at that point, which was a fairly good salary in those days. I mean, I had a friend of mine at Ann Arbor who was making $4,000. We both had graduated at the same time. Michigan State salary were $500 more. That beginning instructor level, and or by that time as assistant professor, and so I think I got out here though some fantastic salary, like $6,500 or $7,000. I don't know. It was, but you know, exponentially, it just seemed incredible increase when you were thinking in terms of maybe a $50 increase 1 year, or maybe if you're really good, you get $100 or $200. My gosh! All of a sudden, your salary practically doubles. So all those things sort of combined to say, well, let's take a chance and go out.
So those factors all
Yeah. I mean, I think putting in order knowing someone like Martin here, so it wasn't completely strange.
Right.
Two, sort of the excitement of a totally new, after all, Michigan State was founded, the first land-grant colleges in 1845 or whatever it was, and that place is thoroughly established, you know, 30,000 people, even then, now it's more like 50. And it was, you were part of a huge institution, you never got to know anyone. You hardly knew people in your department. You had about 30 or 40 people you didn't even met. Then you come out here and you meet everybody. Everyone's in one building, but all departments are in one building. And it was just such a totally new experience. It was sort of a challenge. And so that, and then plus, as I say, the salary and then the uncertainty of tenure and weather all combined.
What was your understanding of the purposes behind the creation of Stony Brook?
Well, I remember that very vividly because they were, Harry Kalish and Martin told me how it started out to be a teacher's college, and then the mandate was totally changed. And that was behind the...
Expanded.
Yeah. Right. And they're coming out here, and that was behind some of the turmoil at the time. Some people had been recruited on the understanding that there was going to be a certain type of college. And then all of a sudden it was to be a graduate center with a rather totally different mandate. And so although I had no illusions as to what the mandate was by the time I was on board, it was going to be a graduate center.
One of the four centers,
yes. And that was made, but in fact, that, frankly, that was one of the positive aspects. It had it been its original purpose of just a four-year college, that wouldn't have been nearly so attractive to me, so that was a plus.
Yeah. Right. What were your impressions of Stony Brook when you first came?
Well, as I indicated, its smallness was such a change. We'd have lunch together, and that means history, economics, sociology, English, and everybody else would sit around the table, and that was it. and that was such a wonderful experience.
Where was the table?
It was in a small room over what is now the Humanities Building, but was sort of a faculty, if you call it lounge, lunchroom with a coffee pot, a round table. Probably could fit in this room very nicely. Not that everyone came at once, but because we had sort of staggered lunch hours, but you could always find a group of six or eight people representing six or so departments, and you got to know people outside your... In fact, you had to, because Martin and I were the only two members of political science when he started out, Merton Reichler. I guess he was the third one, and that was it. So it was hardly a big deal to have lunch with other people. You'd almost have to, just by definition. And so I think that was the overwhelming impression of its intimacy, which, by the way, extended to social occasions, too. Most notably social occasions. There were these faculty play reading groups, I remember.
Yeah.
Do you remember those? Were you part of those?
I never participated.
And, I mean, that was just wonderful. In fact, some of the fact that I know Natalie and Ed Feast so well today, or Tom Irvine, they all stemmed from the play reading groups. Ernie Feingold, Gene Feingold, all those people I never would have met had it not been for those play reading groups. And to this day, we remain very, very good friends. So that was the kind of thing that never had happened and presumably never would happen at Michigan State any more, Carl, than it happens at this university today.
Today,
I mean, that is the price we pay for bigness. Nothing to do about it. Maybe you can try to do something about it, but it will never recapture the days. I mean, people's living rooms aren't big enough to have a play reading group where all the faculty is invited. you just have to do it another way. But so those were my overwhelming impressions.
Did you ever come to Planning Fields?
Only the first graduation was held there, the June of 1763, which I guess was the last graduation that was held there. Or maybe there's one more.
I think they had two there.
Maybe two there. So I went to those, but only in the graduation. Of course, I've been subsequently back because of Martin Summer Institute, but
yes.
I never went there as part of this university in its normal.
We had the head of the British consulate as the speaker in 63,
mm-hmm.
from New York.
Mm-hmm. I do remember that. So the other thing, of course, I recall, just as small as the fact that the library was now where the lunchroom is. Your office was off the library. That was the administration building. And then that building could house library, administration, political science, history, economic, English, sociology, and I guess everything except the natural sciences. That is just right. An incredible fact. When I look at this place today and look at the lunchroom, particularly your office, because sometimes the executive committee would meet in your office. And
it's over across the hall.
Yeah. Now we need a whole building just to house the bureaucracy, which you and your secretary managed to do quite well. I don't know if there's a story in that or not. I'll leave it up
I'm
to you.
I'm trying to find Ann Jensen, my secretary. I don't know where she is.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I'd like to interview her. What events or persons experiences stand out in your mind?
Well,
incidentally, what particular part of political science is your special interest?
Well, at that time, and still is to some extent, comparative politics, European politics, Canadian politics, and politics outside the United States.
Probably following the elections.
Oh, very, very much so, yes. I've subsequently become more oriented toward American politics, but certainly at this time, that was what I was hired for,
mm-hmm.
and because other people were teaching the American stuff. And, but under the question of what events, what persons, what experiences, of course, from the early years, I suppose one thing that stands out in my mind was that, interesting, we talked about Dave Tilley. From the very beginning, this campus had a problem with students. And I think ultimately it's a problem that we've never gotten rid of, that this is almost a commuter college. I mean, that the people live in their own homes on the weekends and use this. And so that's just a problem we're stuck with to this day. But I remember you, Carl, asking me to, I forget what the mandate was, but it had something to do with all student behavior or something like that. And I think two things were operating here. And I'm perhaps combining this with what's happened in the next two or three years after that, perhaps even after Dave Tilley left. We're getting into a drug culture, which I didn't realize we were getting into. Of course, see, coming out from Michigan, I couldn't quite figure out what was a national trend and what was peculiar to Eastern Long Island, where I happened to end up. I now realize that was just part of a national trend getting started. Also, and now it's coming to me, before the drugs, it was just this whole sexual revolution which was taking place. I mean, my gosh, when I went to school, and Rowena went to school at Michigan State, from whence we came, there were parietal hours, there were where men had to get out of the dormitory, and all this, that's a big campus, but that was Midwest, and undoubtedly the sexual revolution started east and went, and it took the Midwest a little time to change in the way that ultimately we all have, but I think those were certain scandalous, so-called scandalous things which were taking place here. Some parents were complaining. And I, And of course, coming from my own background at Michigan State, and since this was a state university too, I took what would undoubtedly call the conservative position that this was the norm. Anything outside, this had been done for hundreds of years this way, it was still being done this way in places like Michigan State. Why wasn't it being done this way out here? Well, the answer, I think, became obvious as we now see co-ed dormitories and everything else. But we were sort of the first wave of that, and you, as administrative officer, were stuck with seeing this wave. I don't know if you knew what hit you or not. I certainly, in retrospect, did not know what hit me. And then, as I say, 3 or 4 years later, you got the same thing with drugs. And again, I didn't know, couldn't quite see this in this global perspective, which, from the vantage point of 1988, it's easy to put that in more perspective. But at the time, when you're living through it, it's tough. And Tilly was stuck with that too. I mean, he was, people like me expected him to enforce a type of behavior which we expected, yet was obviously going out of style, starting from the end of Eastern Long Island, or maybe it's San Francisco and Eastern Long Island, they sort of converged, finally caught up with the rest of the country.
One of my frustrations was that I was here with the responsibility and a kind of vague authority, but only until a president could be found. And I never knew from 1 year to the next when that would happen.
That's right.
I did not feel that I could take strong measures. By that I mean firing Dave Tilly, in whom I didn't have confidence.
Well, I suspect you didn't.
If I had been president with full authority, I certainly would have gotten somebody of a different kind from Dave.
Of course, the question is, would he have been any more successful? I don't know. Maybe he would have.
I don't know either.
Yeah.
But Dave and I didn't always see eye to eye.
Because like you, I blamed Dave at the time. Maybe I should have. I don't. But I, as I said, I have more of a historical perspective on it now. Maybe it wasn't his fault. Maybe something was happening.
We were getting a lot of unfinished business from the home.
Yeah, precisely.
And I didn't quite realize, to start with, the kind of people we were getting. In terms of the extent to which they were not housebroken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We were getting that kind of person.
Yeah. And it's well, to this day, the dormitory life, and so, as you know, continues to be a problem in this campus. And when you look at it from that perspective, we just wonder how much of it was Tilly's fault and how much was these forces over which no one apparently can have complete control. At least, Carol, those days we didn't have shootings, for crying out loud. Maybe we should be thankful. Maybe. But it's just very hard to judge what went on there.
I had something to do it on one occasion with the Suffolk police, and talked with them in connection with the case that we had. And I happened to be standing next to a chap in the narcotics squad.
Mm-hmm.
He asked me if we had any drugs on the campus. And I said, to my knowledge, we don't. That was 63.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, you will. It's coming out from the city.
Yeah.
And we certainly did 5 years later.
Well.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Okay.
But so I certainly remember that incident. In fact, as I talk about it, it came to mind that it was indeed started out as the sexual revolution, and 5 years later it was the drug revolution.
What individuals stand out in your mind?
Well,
students faculty or?
Well, I've certainly had occasion to remember the first student I had in my class. It was Lenny Spivak.
Oh, yeah.
Who's now earning $800,000 a year, I understand. So,
is that right?
So my chairman tells me he's trying to hit him up for some alumni contributions. But I was impressed. My gosh, what a quality of student we have at this place. Did I ever make the right decision coming from Michigan State, which got the lower end of the student, many of the brighter students went to University of Michigan. And wow, these students were just crackerjack students. And so I certainly remember.
Do you have Lenny's address by any chance?
The alumni just called over there. He was president of the Alumni Association, and he's still very active in affairs.
I want to get him in.
He lives in Manhattan.
Yeah.
He can afford to live there. So I certainly remember that. Outside the.
Did you have anything to do with local government here on the island?
No, not local government. I certainly remember I was pretty active in school board politics, and I remember the big meeting we had in our gymnasium when the two districts merged. It was. For Stony Brook School District and the Setauket School District, and to merge, you had to have a meeting of everybody, and the university gym was the only place that could accommodate all those people. And then at the meeting also, we would elect in the school board, but I was very active in those of us who had a pretty good idea of the kind of school board we wanted. And particularly with regard to whether or not the then superintendent, Gelinas, would be appointed the new superintendent of the amalgamated school district. And there were those of us, I suppose he would refer to them as the university crowd, sort of preferred that it was time to bring in outside blood. And we knew that school board election would be determining who got appointed to the new supervisory post from outside, or whether it would be Gelinas. And that was one of the most exciting moments of my life, to see our side come out. I mean, gosh, you must have 500-600 people in the gym that night. And we mobilized our supporters well, and we won. We won, and that's when Stan Ross, by the way, was one of our candidates. We had a slate of candidates that we campaigned for, and interesting enough, everyone won except Stan Ross. Stan Ross was the one person. We ran six people: Bill Crawford, Mondo Roberts, and I forget who else. Maybe it was Dwayne Davis. We tried to get a fairly representative group, and many of whom had served on one or the other school boards. Yeah, but we put Stan Ross. But perhaps reflecting the community was maybe a little fearful that university was taking over. he was the only university person on that slate, and he got defeated. But in any case, enough of them won so that they did indeed go outside and got Francis Roberts to be then the first superintendent.
Did you know that I was one of three to recommend to the board the candidates?
No, I may have known that one time, forgotten.
And I was the one who recommended Stan Roberts.
Uh-huh.
Fran Roberts, yeah. Even though he was not previously a superintendent.
Uh-huh.
That was supposed to be the case.
Uh-huh.
But
he came out of the high school in the island there, so.
Yes.
Well, that was a great moment. and I won't, I say the life of the university, well, it happened in the university gymnasium, but the life of the total community.
What did you think about the reaction of the community to the university?
Well, my, it was, it's sort of funny. In one case, in one sense, there was no town gown problem like I thought there would be, because there was no mixture at all. So on the one hand, I thought, gee, this university, this doesn't exist as far as the area goes. But on the other hand, there was no doubt about it that when it came to proposals, as this is in John Toll's days, you remember that wonderful meeting that was held over to the local school where John Toll wanted to build university housing up along the highway, and the conservationist, after whom the junior high school is named,
Murphy?
Yes.
Bob Murphy.
Bob Murphy got up and made this wonderful speech where he invoked the Old Testament about the, remember that? The rough places shall be made smooth, and the crooked places straight, because the state of New York came and what had been, and Murphy started to name all the plant species which had been around this area. The state of New York came and just leveled it, you know, made the rough places smooth and the crooked places straight, and the audience just roared, you know, with shouts of approval. And now they want to go up there and build some other monstrosities, etc., etc. Well, no doubt that once the university began to impact on the local community with things like that, and of course it's still going on, we're wanting to build housing and that's being disputed, there's no doubt that the university had, and people like Ferd Geese around, made a political career about being anti-university. I must say, what has, as I'm sure you would agree, what has done more than anything else to quiet that antagonism is the Fine Arts Center. Once that came online, and the wonderful music and drama and activities, which are free virtually, many of them are free or for a token amount, right here at the doorstep, that antagonism, and the hospital too, I mean, that antagonism is tempered a great deal from what it used to be when we... There didn't seem to be any pluses, just a lot of minuses. I'm sure you can answer that question much better than I for those early years.
Well, I think Ward Melville was also very strongly in favor of the university, even though he didn't like the architect.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Well, let's see. Have your expectations worked out well?
Yes, I would say that everything I expected, and no doubt more, has come here. I don't see how anyone who came at that time couldn't answer that in a positive way. I can see perhaps someone who've come 10 years ago when they were told about departments going to be expanded and so forth, only to have budgets cut back. But anyone who came in the early 60s, I don't see what more they could have expected than what's happened.
Did you have any connection with Albany?
No, I never had. Except the only time, Carl, when I was secretary, I don't know if you remember this, we had as our commencement speaker we had a private plane chartered, and I went up and accompanied him back. We flew up to Albany, picked him up, he got in the plane, turned around, came back, landed at the... Now, who would that have been? It would have, was there, I don't think it was Boyer, it was, who was, for, anyway, maybe it was an interim chancellor that first couple of years? Before Boyer came?
Wasn't Galbraith, was it?
I,
when we, remember when we had commencement out in front of the library?
Yeah, it might have been. But I know that I flew up. Apparently he could, his schedule was such that he could only, if he could fly down, we had a charter plane. And so I flew up in this little Piper Cub type plane and greeted him, put him, we got on the plane, turned around and came back.
I don't remember.
That would have been in this.
Was he somebody you think from the
Oh, well, I think he was the acting chancellor or something like that.
Wasn't Sam Gould.
It was Sam Gould.
Was it Sam Gould?
Yes, it was.
I see.
Yes.
Okay.
That could have been the fall of this he commencement of 64.
He came in 64.
Okay,
yes.
It would have been the following year then.
I see.
Yeah, yeah. But that's the only contact I had with all of the very, very short one indeed.
Okay. Can you get into the development of the department in its expansion? What particular branches of political science are we involved in?
Yeah, well, I think the big turning point in my department was when Joe Tannenhaus came as chairman, and I was on the recruitment committee that got him from the University of Iowa, and he came with some very definite ideas about what could be what he used to call the cutting edge of political science. So we cut out, he articulated one area in particular, which he was interested at the time, and he called, it's gone by various names, but I think the most generic term would be political psychology, examining person's political judgments in terms of psychological factors, or indeed for a while he was even called them biological factors. But in any case, I think our department is still known for that emphasis. As a matter of fact, Milton Lodge just told me yesterday he got another $100,000 from the National Science Foundation.
Really?
Yeah, so we've had a lot of money come in from outside funding for this type of thing. And to the extent that our department is known nationally for a particular emphasis, it would indeed be that.
The psychology of
Political decision making, particularly voted ordinary people, how they form political judgments, and all of which then, of course, is manifested in their voting choices.
Do you do any polling?
With very very little in the terms of sample survey polling. It's more based on the cognitive process. As I say, there's a very close relationship with psychology. In fact, some of the our departments are very close for that reason. So it's not survey responses so much as it's based on psychological theories, based rather than just how people respond to questions. Although oftentimes the way people do respond to questions is the data they use to try to figure out the psychological processes under that. I must say, I'm not a good one to ask. This isn't my own interest or specialty. But in nature of your question, the strength of our department, and when that happened, that would have been Joe Tannenhaus when we recruited him in 1969. The academic year 69-70 is when he came. And he had a great impact on the department, and which is still there.
Mm-hmm. What else in the department? Martin is.
Martin's international law. But I must say that right now, if you look at it from a total historical perspective, as opposed to just the last two or three years, the major emphasis on the department has not been in international or comparative politics area. And this was not accidental. It was a conscious decision of which I took some part, even though my own interest was in comparative politics. It was pretty obvious that we weren't going to be a huge department like, say, University of Michigan or Michigan State, and which could have area specialists in Africa and Asia and Europe and so forth, South America. And that's sort of like a bottomless pit. Once you start down that road, you're never going to be able to complete it. And wouldn't it be better to use your limited resources to develop more manageable? And I think probably we've taken that too far now, because now I think there's, and maybe it's, if we could do some of the decisions over, knowing that there are going to be budget constraints in later years, I think those decisions would have been different. Because we always figured, well, we can always hire when we need someone in this area, someone in that area. Well, then of course, when you only have one line and how you're going to use it, then some of those other considerations get pushed aside. So as a result, I think we're fairly weak in the international comparative area now. In fact, I know we are. Our major areas of strength, I think, have come with our